Spring, right? Yeah. So I was actually going to do a continuation of what I talked about 2 weeks ago, but then this morning I was meditating and I thought I'm not going to. I'm going to do something else. So I'll do a continuation of what I did 2 weeks ago in 2 weeks.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe. Who knows? So what I wanted to talk about tonight was something that you actually can't talk about. So it'll be kind of interesting to try and circle around to get to it. Because I think that's the only way you can talk about it, is to not talk about it, but sort of talk about the space around it, if you will. So when I was meditating this morning, I was having a cup of coffee and sitting on the couch over there, but I just got really meditative, and then one thing led to another, and I kind of sort of sank into it, sort of a Zen-like thing, I guess. And it occurred to me that when you get really deeply into meditation, when you get really deeply into yourself, what you end up with is just, here I am, I exist. And I just sort of hung out with that, here I am, I exist, which seemed perfectly fine, because at my age anyway, here I am, I just exist, is pretty good versus the alternative. And so that's what I was thinking. And of course, when you're meditating, you're not really supposed to be thinking. But on the other hand, when you're meditating, I mean, whatever is happening is what's happening, and there's just sort of different levels of yourself that are coming up, and it's kind of okay to sort of hang out in those different levels and then go back to what you're trying to do, whatever that is. So I was thinking, well, where did the idea come from that here I am, I just exist, and that's better than the alternative? I mean, why do I even think that there is an alternative, a place where I'm not going to exist? I mean, I've seen people die. I've watched both my parents die. But I have no idea what their experience was. I mean, they were there, their bodies were there, and then their bodies were gone, but I don't know what their experience was. But, you know, this morning I'm sitting on the couch right there and thinking, well, this is better than the alternative, but where did that idea of an alternative come from? Where did the idea of non-existence come from? I mean, here I am, I exist, I felt like I'm here, I am. But my mind was thinking there's an alternative, that I'm not. And where does that come from? And so I kind of looked at that, and, you know, the first place you think of is, well, it's like the big sleep, right? Like when you're in dreamless sleep, you don't exist. But we know that's not true, because if you cease to exist when you're sleeping, you wouldn't wake up. But somehow you have this idea that not existing is like dreamless sleep, which of course it isn't, but yet in some way you think of that as the alternative to existing. Oh, not existing would be kind of like when I'm asleep and not dreaming, but it can't possibly be like that. So where does this idea come from? And in the context of Buddhist philosophy, where the idea comes from is that the Buddhists understand that every idea defines its opposite, and every idea is defined by its opposite. So somehow we have an idea of what non-existence is based upon our idea of existence, right? But if you think about it, then that also doesn't really make very much sense, because you're sort of having this fantasy about what non-existence is, because you still don't know what it is. based upon assuming that it's the opposite of what this is. So this is a total mental trip. It's a total mental fabrication of not this. And you think you know what not this is because you think you know what this is, but how can you possibly? Now, Buddhist philosophy takes this in all kinds of interesting ways, and I'll give an example of this, then I'm going to come back to this question of existence, non-existence. For example, time. There's a big thing in Buddhist philosophy about time. And of course, time is a big thing for us because, again, if you go back to the idea of life and death, which is basically what I'm talking about here, this is all about a future which is different than a present and different than a past, presumably. Anyhow, your whole idea about non-existence is somehow associated with time in some way. A time will come when I cease to exist. Like my brother, who's a very intelligent person, is completely freaked out about the idea of the world existing without him in it. Mm-hmm. Right? He has this idea that the world will exist without him in it, and he's freaked out about it, so he never thinks about it. But he always thinks about it because he's never thinking about it. Right? So it's always on his mind and kind of running him in certain ways because he doesn't pay any attention to it. It bothers him. Which is not to put my brother down. It's just that he has this unexamined idea that's kind of rattling around and driving things. So, but again, that's connected with the idea of time. So what Buddhists point out, what Buddhist philosophers point out in regards to time, is that you only know the future based upon a definition of your idea about the future is it's not the present and it's not the past. That's all the future is. It's not the present and it's not the past. It can't be anything else but not the present and not the past. But the problem with that is, how do you define the past? You define the past as not being the present and also not the future. So you see where this is going to go. And how do you define the present? Organically, you define it as here it is. But when you think about it, the present is not the future and not the past. Right? So they go into this even farther, but this is the thumbnail. Right? So the thumbnail is past is defined by present and future. Present is defined by past and future. Future is defined by past and present. So what is that? And that's what time is. So where does that leave us? It's a tautology, I think, is the right word for it, which is these three things mutually define each other, but there's nothing standing outside of them that tells you anything. So actually, it's a complete mental trip that, I mean, again, from the Buddhist point of view, you can't find time. It's just this idea that pops up when you don't examine its basis, which is these other ideas which only mutually define each other. Okay. So there's a lot of this that goes on, but the place where I began was, so existence defines non-existence. But the interesting thing then is non-existence actually defines existence also, because Buddhists long have pointed out something that the cognitive psychologists have only recently discovered, which is that we don't know things by knowing things. We know things by saying it's not that other thing. The way we know things is by looking at the environment and identifying what in the environment is not something and what's left over is the thing. Does that make any sense? Yeah, okay. So it's sort of like saying, what's Oregon? Oregon is not Washington, it's not Idaho, it's not California, it's not Nevada, etc., etc. It's what's left over. And then, oh, okay, so that's, and it's also not the Pacific Ocean. So, I mean, that sounds a little strange, but that really is the way the cognitive process works. So Buddhists have been saying this for a long time, and so the cognitive psychologists are also saying this, that that's actually the way the perceptual and cognitive process works. And if you look at the way vision works, that is the way vision works. The way you become aware of something is by saying it's not all this other stuff and what's left over is that. So basically I become aware of Kala by ignoring everything else. But I have to see it before I can ignore it is the interesting thing. Then I can ignore it and then I see Kala. At least that's what they say. So this means This means that this state, which we have no understanding of, defines our notion of what it means to exist. I mean, if we stop trying to think about it and we're just here, it's no problem. Like, oh, fine. But as soon as we start thinking about it, then something else happens. And it gets really mushy and mucky, okay? And so that's where the problem is, that we're thinking about it. And we're not it anymore. We're thinking about it. So that's why I said I was going to have a hard time talking about this. I was going to be talking around this by way of sort of getting at that. So what is that? So the Buddhist scriptures say that, and that's what they call that. They call it that because they know they can't call it anything. Sometimes they call it thusness, but mostly they just call it that because they can't call it anything else. So for one thing, that is what you really are, for starters. Because if it wasn't what you really are, you wouldn't know it. I mean, how could you? I mean, if you weren't it, how could you know it? It would be other than you. And if it was other than you, you couldn't really know it. Now, we think we know lots of things that aren't us, okay? But subjectively, I'm not talking about like through our sense organs, right? Subjectively, through our kind of inner senses or through our mind or through our sense of what exists, we can only know what is because it's us. I mean, if it wasn't us, we wouldn't be able to know it. Does that make any sense? Maybe. Maybe it doesn't make any sense. I'll try getting at it a different way. I said this is going to be hard. But I was meditating this morning and the message was, this is what I'm supposed to talk about, so I'm going to try. I mean, you know. Okay, so yeah, I think I'm feeling stumped right now. Let's see if I can get back to it. Yes.
So,
rescue me.
Like an artist who draws using negative space.
Yes.
The picture emerges from
right.
the negative space.
Right.
So is it kind of like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Or like making an elephant, and you get from a block of marble, you knock everything off the block that doesn't look like an elephant.
Right.
Sort
and then the elephant shows up.
Yeah, and the elephant mm-hmm. comes out of there after you knock
mm-hmm.
everything off.
Right. Right, or the way my garden is developing, which is sort of like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I take something away or put
filtering.
Something in.
Hmm? Filtering.
Filtering.
Removal.
There you go, okay.
Brings the essence.
Right, and the garden is emerging by all the mistakes I make, and mm-hmm. all, you know, it's like one thing at a time. Yeah, mm-hmm. right. It's like
the Russians call that nyet, nyet, nyet. Just,
yeah.
Not this, nope, not that.
Not that.
And that tends to be how they live their lives.
Well, the Hindus call it neti, neti, neti.
Oh. Yeah,
not this, not this, not this. And that's actually the Buddhist way.
And
which
who
is
calls
it
bring me another stone?
I don't know. Who calls it bring me another stone?
Not that one, but bring me another. Oh, that's on the
African. Is that what it is?
Well, I don't know.
I'm just joking. My rope. That's not it. So bring me another.
Hmm.
Hmm.
I call it asking 20 questions. Tell me what you want.
So from a meditative point of view, when you find yourself sitting there and just noticing that you are, then immediately the way in which you understand that you are is because there's some part of you that's already thinking about are not. And then the thing is that as soon as that happens, you no longer are, because your combination of is and isn't coming together at the same time, which is a problem because isn't is a total fantasy, and yet it defines your notion of is. So at that particular time, then you're no longer just being. Okay. So the tricky thing about Buddhist meditation, when you in what we've been teaching here, we've been talking about the use of images to focus the mind and to evoke certain mental states. And when that happens and you get really solidly into focus on yourself as that, as soon as you start thinking you know what that is, it's already lost its nature. And the problem is that your mind won't let you just be that. So if you meditate yourself as Green Tara, as we will be practicing, as soon as you fully feel that you are, and you're fully focused on that, and you notice that you are, then immediately what will happen is you'll start wondering about what it is and what does it mean, and then it won't be anymore. And if you don't do that and allow yourself to be Green Tara without wondering about it, then you will be, and then the essence that's beyond is and is not will emerge in that form. So there's this fine dance, this fine line that you walk of allowing yourself to do something that from the modern, especially Western point of view, is ridiculous, which is to imagine yourself as, if you're a guy, a green woman, and if you're a woman, a green woman, which is still pretty ridiculous. If you just allow yourself to do it and be it and allow that to fully be and to emerge into that fully, then its essential quality, which is you, is there and everything is okay. Which is really hard for us to do because we're so rational. And as soon as we get rational about it, it's gone. Now, you know, you could say that this is sort of like an act of faith. The problem with saying that this is sort of like an act of faith is that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, as soon as that word faith pops up, it's kind of a problem, because faith pops up in the context in the way most of us are raised as, don't ask any questions about it, just have faith in it. So this is not the faith that I'm talking about. I'm talking about having faith that it's okay to do something that mentally will strike you as being completely ridiculous, and you don't have to think about it, and you can just sort of wait and see what it is by letting it be what it is, which is a real challenge, because that's the last thing in the world we want to do, is just let it be what it is, because we want to think about it, we want to understand it, and we want to know, why am I imagining myself as being a green woman? And then everything becomes a problem at that particular point. Okay. So, again, and I'll wrap it up at this point. So what emerges when you don't do that, when you stop doing that, what emerges if you're just being Green Tara? What emerges is a state which is not is, also is not not is. Okay, it's not existence, it's not non-existence, and it's not both of them, because that would be the first thing that your mind, it must be both of them, that's what your mind will do. It's somehow, you know, this Buddha nature that I'm finding in myself in the form of Green Tara, it must be a combination of exists and doesn't exist. No, that's not it, because that's just your mind trying to get another thing together there of somehow it's a combination of the two things. And you'll say, then it's neither of those things. And the Buddha say, nope, that's not it either. Because if you reject them both, then there's nothing, nothing at all. And they're not saying it's nothing at all. So what they say is that your mind will look at four alternatives to the condition that you're in, if you let it. One of which is existence, one of which is non-existence, one of which is some sort of fantasized idea about what the two of them together might be, which is sort of maybe a metaphoric mind. And one of which will say, it's not any of the above, which also isn't true. So whatever is beyond all those four is what you're waiting to have emerge when you don't let your mind think about all those four. And that's the goal. But we don't know what it is. We can't know what it is. And yet, somehow we have to strive for it. And the irony is that it's worth striving for precisely because it's utterly incomprehensible. And if it was comprehensible, it wouldn't be worth striving for. Because if it was comprehensible, right, we'd either, what? It wouldn't be what it is. Because it would be our mind having this idea of what it was because it's comprehensible. So what we strive for is fundamentally incomprehensible. Not non-existent, something beyond anything that we can wrap ourselves around. Now, Kay has been sitting here for 10 minutes looking at me like, what is he talking about?
No, I'm just trying to cut this. Okay, so but what comes up, and I'm going to ask you this,
sure.
Is that can you talk a little bit then about what the difference is between sitting there and rising as the green woman, green Tara, you know, and going to that place you're talking about that isn't or isn't, and the difference between sitting there like a Zen practitioner with just following the breath and going to that place that is or isn't. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. So if a Zen practitioner is following the breath, they're still in a place of is because they're watching their breath,
okay.
Which is a place of is. Which, there's nothing wrong with being a place of is. You know, I mean, it's good that you're breathing. That's a real good thing. Breathing is a good thing. You know, there's complete chaos at the university, as some of you know, and John Norris put up a saying on the wall to help people keep things in perspective, which he learned from his scuba divers. And the saying is, keep breathing. Everything else can be fixed. That's helpful.
Yeah.
That's helpful. The point is, if you're following the breath, you're into is. You're into is. The difference between following the breath and meditating yourself as green Tara is green Tara is something which is beyond breath. And it represents kind of an intrusion into the world of is and is not, of that which is beyond is and is not. And I can't say anything more about that without bringing that into the world of is. And as soon as I... See, that's the problem with this, okay? And it's also...
So if you experience it without thinking about it, you're there.
Yeah.
Without naming it,
without thinking about it, but fully being it.
But as soon as you go, oh, I'm doing it, cool, then you're out of it.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
It's a human dilemma, though.
It is.
That's like with acting, same exact thing. I tell my actors, quit looking at yourself while you're acting. As soon as you realize you're acting, you're not acting, you're pretending.
Oh, interesting.
So you have to be in the mood of the character, mixing your body with theirs and creating this thing. But if you know you're creating it, then you're not in it. Mm-hmm.
And
then
you're
watching yourself.
How do they achieve that?
It's very meditative.
They can practice.
They can have all the skills in the world and all the technique in the world, but there's something about the good ones that it's sort of seamless between the is and the is not.
Mm-hmm. There
it's
you go.
Just, it's a faith thing in the best kind of faith, which is an acceptance that you're in a world that you're in a place that is and is not. Mm-hmm.
And music is the same thing. Mm-hmm. You really nail it. You're there. And
yeah.
It is really. I do this all the time. It's like I'm there. Wow, that was really cool. And then I'm not there anymore. And then, but if
you're like that a lot.
Yeah. That's the way I live my life. I'm free. Thank you.
That wasn't helpful.
It's a tricky situation because you could conclude that it means something like, if you're really stupid enough, everything is okay. Mm-hmm. Like you're unconscious, and therefore it's fine, because mm-hmm. it just is. But that's not it, because there is self-consciousness and self-awareness and self-monitoring, but there's not a cognitive separation that's going on. I don't know how else to phrase this. I mean, at this point, I mean, I think you did, you know, Brian, April, you said it in a way that I can't say it any better. I just want to emphasize that the notion of it being almost like insentient is not where it's at. So I'll close with a kind of a, I don't know, it's not scripture, but so when Buddhism came to Tibet in the 7th and 8th century AD, Tibet was surrounded by Buddhists, actually. It's one of the reasons that the royal house of Tibet kind of imported Buddhism. They were developing an empire at the time. Hard to think of the Tibetans having an empire, but they actually did. They were fighting the Chinese on one side and the Arabs on another side, and they actually had troops that went all the way down to what we now call the Bay of Bengal on ancient ancient Arab maps. The Bay of Bengal is called the Tibetan Sea, really old ones. So they had this empire that was very extensive, and every place they went were Buddhists, so they figured, well, that must be the thing, so we'll have some Buddhists come to Tibet. So they had Chinese Buddhists, who were mostly Zen, coming to Tibet, and they had Indian Buddhists who followed this kind of different tradition of gradual development of skills. Graded path is what it was actually called. Anyhow, so things got really confusing in Tibet. It's a little bit like, you know, the Buddhist situation in the United States now. There's the Vipassana people, and there's the Tibetan people, and the Zen people. And a lot of disagreement about things if you don't fully understand how these things relate to each other. If you do, there's no disagreement at all. But if you just sort of do one thing and you don't understand the other things, they seem really odd and different to you. It's like, how can they all even be Buddhism? So that happened in Tibet. But unlike democratic America, Tibet was a feudal society. There was a king, and there were many high, you know, princes and whatnot. But the king could say, we got to solve this problem and actually do something about it. So he said, let's have a big debate. We'll get the Chinese over here, and we'll get the Indians over there, and they'll each put forward their best guy, and we'll have a debate about what the truth is, because the problem we're having here fundamentally is the graded path, you know, gradualist folks from India, and the instantaneous, you know, see into your own nature Zen guys from China seem to be saying something really different. So I have a big debate and we'll solve the problem. And so the Chinese Zen monk sort of put his thing out about Zen practice, and that if you just stop thinking, that's it, if you just stop thinking, everything is going to be okay. So this is, right, 8th century Tibet, you know, they didn't have television and all that kind of stuff. Imagine the kind of minds they have. But they, even back then, they said, stop thinking and everything will be okay. And so that's what Buddhist practice is. And so then the Indian guy got up and said, I don't think so, because if that was the solution to the problem, then all you'd have to do is get falling down drunk, which would be a whole lot easier than meditating, and that would solve the problem. And it doesn't. So the moral of that story, and by the way, the king said the Indian guy must be right. The moral of that story is just stopping the thought process isn't enough. I mean, we can talk about being there and not thinking, but you have to be conscious, self-conscious, there. And not thinking, not unconscious there, and not thinking. So when you're in the sweet spot with music, you're aware of it in some way. You're not having this thought process that you're there, but you know you're there. And the same when you're acting and you're really there, you know it. But as soon as you start thinking, wow, I'm really doing it, that's when you're not doing it anymore, right? That's the difference between the two. So those are different kinds of self-consciousness. So not about insentience.
Can I make a comment?
Absolutely.
about 15 years ago, I went to Naropa, where I was trying to figure out what I believed, and I decided to go for a couple months and sit every day and every night and try not to think of anything. And it didn't work at all for me because, as a visual person with nothing to visualize, the act of not thinking about something was so, I was so self-aware that I was not thinking, oh my God, I'm not thinking now, yay, oh, whoops,
right,
crap, you know, that kind of thing. So, and you could just see it, you know, with people who did just sort of this zone out thing, and I'm sure it worked great for some people, but for me it was, you know, I was always feeling like, God, there's got to be some other way to do this, you know? So having, and I think I've talked about this before here, that this visualization of this image, which you become and is you and not you at the same time, and you're unaware of you're being different from that thing, and it's yes now, but it's not now, but it's, you know, I can see how the Tibetans, who are so visually, you know, you look at the Chinese, that they have a rich culture, but there's a lot of fairness to it, and you look at the Tibetans, and even their simple houses seem just beautiful and textural, and you can just see where the Tibetans needed that other piece, that the piece that allows you to take a real incredible trip with, in the best sense of trip, with the green taro, and you see her, and she is you. But how can you try to think nothing? I mean, how can anybody?
Well,
in America right now, such a visual culture, think of nothing. It's so difficult.
Well, you can't think of nothing, because as soon as you're thinking of nothing, you turn nothing into the object of thought, which means it's already something. And as you discovered it in Naropa, when you're making all this effort to not think, what's happening is the part of you that's usually thinking is now into, I'm not thinking, I'm not thinking, I'm not thinking, which is another kind of thinking. Yeah, it's another kind of thinking.
But
even what they say in Zen, and maybe that nobody told you this at Naropa, but what they say in Zen is, if you think of your mind is like space, like the sky, that kind of space, totally spacious, open, and, you know, clouds float across. Those are like your thoughts. Clouds float across. So, you know, beginning practitioners, you know, the cloud floats across and go, whack, get out of here. Whack, get out of here. But after you've been practicing for a while, it's kind of like the cloud floats across, and it's not like, oh, there's a cloud, because then you're thinking of it. It's more like, my mind is spacious, and it's just as spacious whether there are clouds in it or not. And clouds are floating in my spacious mind. That's okay, because I have a spacious mind. It's not like you're thinking this. It's the stance that you're in, which is the spaciousness of mind. That's the that I was talking about earlier. Now I'm naming it something a little bit different. The spaciousness of mind is just there, and stuff floats through it. And this is, again, like a Zen analysis. Stuff floats through it. But if you're a really good practitioner, it's sort of like, You know, it's the cloud starts over here on the west, and eventually it ends up over there on the east, and it's gone. You don't have to do anything about it. It's just going to go. And the space is just there. The cloud just floats across it. You don't get nailed by the cloud. You're not obsessed by the cloud. It just floats across, and that's okay.
I
you're
think a lot
in
of
the space.
Are so desperate in Zen at times that you're so excited when the cloud comes.
Well, that could be. I can see that.
Yeah, like, you know, I can think about how to be like this cloud and be open and vaporous and not judgmental, and, you know, so it's sort of like, I don't know, Yeah, it was very exciting when something like that happened, just when some visual piece.
Well, because you were so vision starved at that point.
Yeah.
But if you're into this spacious mind and the clouds float through it, then the thing you have to be careful about is not turning the spacious mind into a big cloud. Mm-hmm. Like spacious mind. Okay. Uh-oh, that's just a big cloud now, okay? No. So now you've got this big cloud floating in your spacious mind. But the thing is, it's okay to have water vapor penetrating the space of space. Mm-hmm. That's an okay thing. Because you can be in the space with a water vapor floating through it, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, that's actually quite natural. So you don't have to feel uncomfortable about it happening. You just don't get hooked up, you don't get hooked by the water vapor / cloud thing that's going on. And that's it's actually a very comfortable place to be. And, you know, then of course you'd be thinking, wow, I exist. And then, you know, the space is filled with water vapor again, you know, and okay. Just let it go. It'll, you know, go back to. Or, you know, the space is green Tara, really. I mean, that's, you know, and if you get into thinking about green Tara as the space, then it's all screwed up. But if you let green Tara be the space, or the space be green Tara, without kind of. You can just sort of hang in that place. You can hang in the place of being green Tara. Just like mostly you hang in the place of being me. And you don't really fret about, I'm feeling me. That only seems natural. It's more complicated when you're not me anymore and you're green Tara. Mm-hmm. Then you can start fretting about it. But if you get to the place of not fretting about it, then it's just very good and very peaceful. And, you know, stuff floats through and it just floats out the other side. You don't have to worry about it. It's okay.
And that's the thing in meditation, where in the beginning we're always going, be relaxed, mm-hmm. and alert. Mm-hmm. It took me years and years and years to figure out. Doing Zen practice and Tibetan practice, that's really the key. Mm-hmm. You've got to be really deeply relaxed to let the clouds fly, yeah, or to hang there, mm-hmm. Tara. But you also have to be alert, because if you're having mental sinking, you're getting, you know, or being too agitated, you know, then you can't think in that place. Mm-hmm. So want to talk about mental sinking a little bit?
All right.
No thought business too.
Yeah. So what makes it possible to hang in this place is the inherent quality that it has of being wonderful. The usual language for this is bliss. I mean, that's the usual Buddhist language for it is bliss. But, you know, see, that's another word that creates problems. It's like, oh, my inner nature is blissful. It's like, okay, what does that mean? Okay. So I'll just say it's quite wonderful. And if you hang out in the wonderfulness, it's so wonderful that that's good enough reason to hang out in it. And you're not interested in being disturbed anymore, because nothing can come along that's as wonderful as the wonderfulness. So you stop getting disturbed. That naturally arises, and there are multiple levels of more wonderfulness. And every time you get into another level of more wonderfulness, you're less likely to be distressed by anything, because nothing is as wonderful as the wonderfulness. Now, the problem, of course, with hanging out there and allowing the wonderfulness to come forward is before you get there, you might fall asleep, or you might experience what's usually called sinking, because your mind gets dull. And it's like, I'm meditating. Okay.
I'm not thinking.
Boom, right. Because your mind is so used to being stimulated by thoughts that when that stops happening, the alternative is that you get hyper and you get highly agitated, and that happens because you're so used to being in that kind of mentality that's going on that when you stop thinking, all that energy starts running into other stuff, and then you can't get focused. Your mind flops from here to there, and usually there'll be some sort of fantasy that goes along with it. So that's called mental agitation. And so there are cures for those things, which are actually surprising in that they tend to be other thoughts. So, for example, the cure for sinking, I forgot, what is the cure for sinking? I think it's to think about death.
Oh, you're using analysis, because
yeah.
I was going to say that in this Snow Lion that some of you picked up, the rest of you should get them this time, if you can, because there's some wonderful articles on the front page. There's one that gives a visualization, actually, that you can do for mental syncing, and one you can do for agitation. And I'm not familiar with them, so I probably, one of them had to do with sending light up, and I think that's the one that had to do with mental syncing.
Right.
Yeah, up to the top of your head, and up as far as you can visualize it, and that's So there are some visualizations, but there's also the analytical.
Yeah. One thing you can do when you're experiencing syncing is you concentrate on your forehead, on the space between your eyebrows, because this is the place of agitation. Mm-hmm. So if you're syncing, you concentrate on the place of agitation, and if you're agitated, you concentrate on the space 3 inches below your belly button, because that's the place of syncing. So you use the one to counteract the other. I mean, that's the technique that I'm familiar with.
So is it the opposite?
Yeah. Well, if you're agitated, you use the counterforce. Mm-hmm. You know, right. And if you're sinking, you use the counterforce of right. Mm-hmm. But there are other mental things you can do. So for sinking, I don't remember if it's for sinking or for agitation. You think about death. And think what a good thing it is to be alive, and then you stop either being agitated or sinking. Obviously, it doesn't work for me because I can't remember which one you're supposed to use it for. I never get agitated or sink. I just fall asleep.
What's the difference between sinking and falling
asleep? Yeah.
What's the difference between sinking and falling asleep?
You're conscious, but you just dull out. I mean, you're really... And a lot of Zen practitioners for years and years thought that they were having a samadhi. Actually, and then until the Tibetans came in and talked with them and said, "What are you doing?" And as they described it, they said, "That's not a samadhi, that's just mental syncing, where you're in a very dull, conscious state where you're not really thinking, but it's just very dull." Mm-hmm. And it's actually harmful to stay in that.
Yeah,
space
one of our.
Tell my students.
Yeah, one of our teachers said that if you're meditating, you get into a really very deep meditation, and you want to know whether or not you were sinking or not, that when you get up from meditation, pick up a newspaper and try and read. And if everything is very clear and comprehensible to you, then you weren't sinking. But if you try and read and it's kind of like you're having trouble reading, you're sinking. And so the whole... Yeah. Right, so the whole kind of anti-intellectual thing that was associated with a certain dimension of Zen at one time was a huge cultural sinking. Like, don't use your brain. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, no. Turns out that a lot of this came from sort of beatnik Zen practitioners, and a lot of them were students of Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't know was Suzuki Roshi thought Americans were much too intellectual, so he didn't want to do anything intellectual with Americans. And so they thought, oh, you're not supposed to study anything. Mm-hmm. And then one day it was discovered that he had a library and he was always studying. And it's like, what is this Zen master always studying? We thought you weren't supposed to study. Well, no, I didn't, you know. I just, you know, you guys are too intellectual already, so I just never did that thing with you. Of course you need to study stuff. Oh, okay. True story. Okay, I've gone way beyond.
Any other questions, though? Because we're kind of doing our question and answer thing before meditation.
It seems to work out better that way. Yeah, so especially else? Because you guys often, at this point, have much more intelligent things to say than I do, so it works very well. When I get stuck, you have good things to say and rescue me. No? Oh, good. Okay, well, fine. This is kind of a hard one. I mean, you know, the thing about meditating is you do get kind of what I'll call messages. I'll end it with this. You know, it's kind of like you get in touch with a part of yourself that tells you stuff. You know, it's like the Buddha say, you meditate Manjushri, and meditate yourself as Manjushri, you develop wisdom. You meditate yourself as Green Tara, you develop fearless compassion, and so on and so forth. And these things are true. I mean, you kind of get into these places and stuff happens, and you see things in certain ways, and you think, oh, I'm supposed to do this and such a thing. So this morning I was meditating, and it was very good, and the and sort of like, you know, my Buddha nature or whatever said to me, this is what you're supposed to talk about this evening. Didn't tell me what to say. Just said what I was supposed to talk about this evening. So that's the problem side. So, okay.
You're going to turn that off, and that's a good segue for what I want to say.